welcome to our fourth episode of Checking the Gate podcast. I am Robert Wright Stasko, and joining me, my ever plucky sidekick,
Michael M. Patty.
You know, I shouldn't refer to you as a sidekick.
I'm a co-host.
Yeah, we're a team. we're like Wonder Twins. All right. Well, today's episode, we are talking about the controversial movie Dune. Controversial and not so much in its subject matter, but as...
I think it's controversial to people who don't like it.
Yeah. In terms of taste, it's very controversial. Some yes. people like it, and some people don't. And by the end of this podcast, you will know which side we fall on.
Yes.
Our TV corner today is going to be on some episodes of Futurama. We'll pick out some of our favorite scenes and talk about that. But before we get started, I have a little surprise for Mike. I checked the email today, and we got our first reply on the Checking the Gate podcast. Mike posed a question when we were talking about Thor. If there were people who still practiced the heathen religion and actually worship Thor. And I found some right here in the good old U.S. of A.
Nice.
I got in contact with a Mark Ludwig Stinson, who's part of Jotun's Bane Kindred. And they have a website, the Temple of Our Heathen Gods, at heathengods.com. And we were under the impression that modern-day heathens would probably have found Thor to be about as offensive as conservative Christians found the Last Temptation of Christ. So I asked Mark, I sent him an email, and I asked him, how did you feel about the movie Thor? And was it an accurate representation of the actual God? Here's what his response was. First, he apologized for getting back to me late because I asked him about the time we did the Thor podcast. And he was very nice and gracious. And I'm very appreciative of his responding to my question. But he says this, the movie Thor was a fun Hollywood movie full of special effects based on a Marvel comic book character that has been in print since about 1962. While Stan Lee did loosely base the comic book character on Norse mythology and the god Thor, he took a lot of liberties in creating a fictional superhero that would fit in well with the Marvel universe.
Wait, what?
That's just what we said. He goes on to say, it's not an accurate portrayal of the god Thor, though it was not meant to be an accurate portrayal of the god Thor. So, it seems to me he took it in the spirit in which it was given.
How could you not, given the movie that ended up being?
Yeah. So, I recently saw it again with the kids, and they enjoyed it, and since I had seen it and I knew what I was in for, I was able to enjoy it a little more for what it was, just a fun roller coaster ride. I think the first time I went in, I was expecting Hamlet again, and no, we were getting Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. So I watched it with that sort of expectation, and it was an enjoyable movie the second time around.
I'm still not paying more than $5 for it.
I paid 75 cents at the Canton Theater.
Can't beat that with a stick.
No, sir.
Did you ask this gentleman if he actually listened to our podcast?
No. It would be nice if we had, you know, maybe 6 listeners instead of 5. So.
Yeah, so Mark Ludwig Stinson, this episode's for you.
So, and he responded to us at our email address of ctgpodcast@yahoo.com. And if you have anything to say out there, respond to us. We would love to read your email online. So let us know if you prefer to have us read it or not. And, you know, we'll take all comments, good or bad.
We are also on Twitter at CTGPodcast.
So today we're talking about David Lynch's movie Dune, or
Alan Smithy's version Dune, which is the version I watched, the extended television cut. Only because I hadn't seen it before. It had been sitting on my shelf for years, and I needed to give it a spin to justify my purchase of it.
So what did you think?
I love the movie. I can't get enough of it. For the mid-80s, it's got great production value. It's a good, time-tested story. The special effects for the day are fine.
I would say they still hold up.
They definitely do still hold up. Excellent cast. Every single name at the end of the film, for those of you who haven't seen it, at the end of the film they do title cards of showing the actor in character from the film, and then it has the actor's name and then their character, and every single one of them is somebody you've heard of from start to finish. It's really well done, and I enjoyed watching it the other day for the first time in years. I don't know why it took me years to watch it again.
We have Jürgen Prochnow from Das Boot.
Thank you for saying that and not making me.
There is Linda Hunt.
From NCIS Los Angeles, yeah. As the shout-out Mapes.
Yeah. I'm going to take a little detour here. I saw this article as I was wandering around the internet. It's like 13 actors hit with the Oscar curse from CNBC.com. And they said Linda Hunt, she won Best Supporting Actress in 1982 for The Year of Living Dangerously. And it says, after winning the Academy Award, Hunt appeared in a baffling string of films that snuffed out her newfound stardom pretty quickly. Her first movie after the Oscar run was 1984's Dune, which to this day is generally acknowledged to be one of the worst movies ever made.
It does not back that claim up with people who generally acknowledge that either.
Yeah, I like this movie too. I've seen both versions, and I had time to watch both versions again. And I think they both hold up, especially if you're a fan of the book. When I first saw the movie, I had just read the book for the first time, so the addition of the weirding modules kind of threw me for a loop, and I didn't like it at first.
I think it's great. I must have read the book after I saw the movie, because the movie came out when I was just a kid, and I know I saw that when I was still young, because I have a Dune activity book to this day in my possession. So I'm sure I read the book afterward, and I miss the weirding modules. I think those are a great addition, and it adds a little action to what could be a dense and talky and thought-driven movie. It adds some, adds a little rock and roll to it.
Yeah, and I agree with you now, especially because I'm halfway through it right now, reading the book again. And the concept of how the Bene Gesserit use their voice to manipulate people. And this is sort of an extrapolation of that.
Yes.
And I like everything about the movie myself, too. Gene Siskel remarked about how just awful he thought, how disgusting it was. And I love that disgustingness of the Harkonnens, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, all the pussy things on his face. And
kind of the same way that the Star Wars movies made it look like. Somebody said for the first time it looked like the future had a past. And I think as far as Dune goes, the visceral, it looks dirty and real. You know, the sand is everywhere. Blood is everywhere. Pus is everywhere.
Yeah, it takes place in the future. According to the reference materials, it's about 20,000 years in the future. The movie says it's
10191 is what the movie says.
Right, and that's after the Butlerian Jihad, where there was like a Terminator-like uprising where machines had enslaved the galaxy.
Isn't that always the way? Thank God we're not using any machines to record this podcast.
Oh, those robots, they scare the heck out of me.
Robot.
And the robot. We'll get more on robots later in our Futurama part. But that jihad takes place 10,000 years in our future, and then this is 10,000 years after that. But you have a sense of all that history, and even though it's so far in the future, humans are still humans. You have, like, the art of Canley, where all the assassination things, like, were in the movie, that hunter-seeker thing comes out from behind Paul's bed and tries to kill him and almost kills the shout-out Mapes. The politics with the Canley, it's very Machiavellian, and the events that take place are driven as much by politics as they are by religion in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish they would have gone a little more into it. Dr. Yui in the book gives Paul this orange Catholic Bible, and it's so thick and so dense that the pages are just atoms thick, and you can't touch the pages. It uses like static electricity to turn the pages so you can read this book. And it's interesting, you know, like today, like the Bible's been the same for about 1,500 years. But, you know, the fact that the religion would develop and would be in the future, you don't see that a whole lot in science fiction.
And not too often, although somehow we seem to keep coming back to science fiction movies, don't we?
Yes.
they call being a Jedi a religion. Do they ever use the word religion in Dune?
I don't
remember hearing it. I don't know if it's in the book or not. It's been a while since I've read it.
They refer to the beliefs of the Fremen as superstition and prophecy. This is very interesting, where the hero of our story, Paul Atreides, he's also Maldib. He becomes the savior, and sort of a conglomeration of Buddha, Muhammad, and Jesus.
Yeah, there's a little bit of everything thrown in for good measure.
He's like the ultimate messiah figure. So let's talk a little bit about each of these components.
Okay.
You said something interesting to me when you first brought up the idea of doing this as a podcast. It's someone's sort of negative review of Dune. He said it was a handbook of terrorism.
Oh, yes. I had read a comment somewhere that it would be hard to make a new Dune movie because it was pretty much Jihad the movie, which I disagree with upon rewatching it. It's more of a revolution than a jihad because the motives for overthrowing the Harkonnens are not for religious reasons. It's actually more for Paul getting revenge.
Yeah, it's very personal. So but, there's a lot wrapped into it.
But they are clearly depicted as evil, and in the movie they are probably rightfully overthrown to give the Fremen control of the planet.
You see a lot of similarities with Jesus because Paul is foretold in all these prophecies. And in the book it comes out like the Bene Gesserit had planted a lot of these prophecies themselves because they know the power of religion and how it works in people. So they would plant these religions just so when one of their people would show up, they would be received favorably. That is kind of a neat twist how people use religion. They're so in tune with how every social interaction works, and they can use every bit political, religious, economic, to really control not just a planet, but a whole galaxy. And you need every single one of those to have full control. And the Bene Gesserit had sort of the religious part of it, and you had the Space Guild who had the economic part of it, and then the houses who have the political part of it. And then Paul comes through and usurps all of it to himself. In the movie, you see how the weird, creepy tadpole-looking
the guild navigators.
The guild navigators, they use the spice to travel through space. That's so when they fold space, they could see the spice lets them see a bit into the future, so they know where they're going, so they don't end up, you know, in the middle of a star or flying too close to a supernova, and that'll end your trip real quick.
Yeah, get some great pictures though.
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting watching the movie, and they don't have all the subtext about the Bene Gesserit planting the different seeds in different cultures,
yeah.
But in the movie it comes across like all the Bene Gesserits are kind of their own religion, the Fremen are their own religion, the Harkonnens seem kind of the, I don't want to say agnostic, but
the anti-religious.
The anti-religious.
The hedonistics.
And yes, perfect, thank you. The Atreides are sort of waspy, if you will.
Yeah.
And but they all have things in common in their belief systems, kind of like Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. They all have sort of the same seeds at some point,
yeah.
You know, a common ancestor, if you will. And it seemed like the prophecy of Paul either being the rightful heir to the House Atreides or the successor to the Padishah Emperor or the leader of the Fremen is kind of like a god, the Messiah, or the prophet. It's touches all fronts, kind of like our religions in reality.
Yeah, you can see the influence that Frank Herbert, the author of Dune, pulled from all these religions. Like Muhammad, Paul Atreides finds a desert people, unites them, and leads them and gives them a new focus to their religion. Like Buddha, he meditates, you know, using the spice. You know, we see this in sort of the imagery of the film. He goes to that place where Bene Gesserit cannot look and, "Father, the sleeper has awoken." I just tweeted that.
It's technically awakened.
Oh, well.
I guess someone only owns one copy of it.
Yeah, you get the point. Anyways, I need to watch it again, apparently. But
I'll let you borrow my Blu-ray.
I think I prefer the David Lynch version as opposed to the Alan Smithy version, because with that you have, like, I don't know who that is doing the narration. It
sounds like the guy who narrated Frosty the Snowman.
Yeah, I thought at one point it sounded like Robert Loggia, but I could not find anywhere who did that. But because, and in the David Lynch version, the introduction is done by the stunning
Virginia Madsen, who plays Princess Irulan.
And you lose her almost completely in the Alan Smithy version.
I don't think she says anything in the TV version.
No, she says, like...
Yeah, no, she has a couple of lines.
Just, like, a couple throwaway lines.
But she shows up at the end. You have no idea who she is or what she's doing there.
In the book, like, every chapter introduction is a little quote from a book that her character, Princess Cerulean, has written. So that is missing from the extended version. So I prefer David Lynch's original theatrical.
For as much that is left out of the book and left on the cutting room floor, there's like some 40 minutes of extra footage in the extended version.
I like the part where Captain Picard is playing the stick there. Let me say that again. The part where Gurney Halleck, played by Patrick Stewart, is playing his Balisette. You know, it's cool, in the credits, they list the Balisette is inspired by the Chapman stick.
I saw that.
And I'm a big fan of King Crimson and Tony Levin and Trey Gunn, who play touch guitars with sticks and everything. So that was cool for me to see that part. Also, in terms of musicians I love...
Is there a musician in this film?
Sting is the man.
Sting is the man.
He is the most dynamic thing in this movie. He steals every scene he's in.
I will kill him!
It's your turn to Swede. But for your viewing pleasure of the listening audience, we have a honest-to-goodness Dune action figure of Fade Rotha Harkonnen. It's about 6 inches tall.
Maybe five.
And it's a fantastic likeness of Sting.
And it has punching action.
A little lever. I used to have a little knife for him, too, but that got lost in the sandbox or something, because I was in the sandbox playing Dune.
Well, of course.
But then when I was, you know, 18. But we won't talk about that.
Yeah.
Sting, he's just fantastic in this movie. And I know quite a few people of the opposite sex who love the scene where he steps out of the steam shower and is flying space underwear. And he does look impressive. I mean, if I could be Sting, I would be Sting in that. You don't like the scene with the flying space underwear? So Sting is the only thing that's standing in the way of Paul Atreides and his complete domination of the galaxy. But working against Sting's character Fade is all this prophecy. And Paul Atreides is very much the kind of messiah that the Jewish people were originally expecting when Jesus came. And he's very much a military leader like Muhammad was. So you could see the combination of all these religious influences that really all come together at the end. And what did you think about the final scene of the movie, the very end where he makes it rain?
It's not in the book, first of all, and because there are several sequels, so Frank Herbert probably did not intend there to be water on Dune, because then you can't cash in. That said, again, having watched it for the first time in a bunch of years, I get it. I get that it's supposed to be Paul exercising his power and taking control. So as far as that goes, for a shorthand image, I think it works to tie this standalone film together, so I can live with it. If I like the addition of the weirding modules to the movie, then I can tolerate making it rain. Because they do foreshadow it. He does have visions of it, even in the book, I think.
Yeah.
And definitely in the movie, he has visions of it being fertile again, and they pay it off, so...
Yeah. And it actually happens, I think, 4 or 5 books in.
I didn't get that far. I had to stop at the third. They just got too ridiculous for me.
Yeah, they do. I mean, the fifth and sixth books are really wild.
Yeah, first one's a masterpiece. Second one's okay. Third one is whack.
Like in The God Emperor of Dune, there's only a small part of Dune that is actually desert, and the rest of it's like a paradise. So you're skipping a couple thousand pages and cutting to the good part. At first, I agree with you. I just barely tolerated that ending. But now I could see it does finish off the movie nicely, and it does bring out the godlike powers of Paul and really makes it a religious movie. So,
yeah. Do you want to talk at all about the spice and the control of spice and the acquisition of spice and how it relates to what we've previously discussed about if you don't have religion or faith, how it ends up just leading to a quest to acquire things?
Well, share us your thoughts on that.
I think in light of our discussion since we've been doing this podcast, that's something that did strike me, that, you know, a lot of people just on the surface would think it's, oh, that's drugs. They do a lot of drugs in the future, and it's finally legal, and it's encouraged. And I think that's a very superficial interpretation of spice. I think spice and how it is used for spacing, navigation, and in all the food, and I think that could be a symbol for technology or wealth. Just anything that's secular in that sense. I don't think it's just drugs. I think that's a very, you know, yes, the book was written in the 60s, so that's probably, that influence is probably there, no pun intended. In the context of the movie, I don't think it has to be taken that way. I think it can be seen as a metaphor for just getting things, like Robert and I were talking about in one of our previous episodes.
It's power, it's control. Because what it gives you is complete control and mastery over your mind and your body. Later in other books, like there's clones of Paul's father who has like these superhuman abilities to like move fast and stuff.
Really?
We weren't kidding when he said it gets wacky. I mean, just for Paul, it lets him see the future. It lets him see everything that's happened before in the past.
If you do go back to the spice is just drugs, then it loses some of the messianic religious influence. You know, Paul does that because he's the Kwisatz Haderach. He doesn't do it because he's hopped up on spice.
Yeah, and also the spice is not, it's not looked on as a drug. It's looked on as like sort of a perfecter of humanity, because it's through the spice that the Mentats, like the characters of Thufir Hawat
and Peiter DeVries,
played by
Freddie Jones and Brad Dourif, respectively.
Oh yes, the two of our generation's best character actors. They are human computers, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And the spice allows their brain to act like the laptop that we're recording this podcast on. It allows the Bene Gesserit to have complete control over everything that happens in their bodies. Like, they can determine what sex their baby's going to be. They know the instant that they're pregnant. They know how to use their voice to control people. It allows the Spacing Guild to, you know, see into the future. It's not like heroin or marijuana.
It's more like HGH.
Yeah, it is essential to the human condition, and it allows the galaxy to function. So without this spice, you would not have a Kwisatz Haderach. You would not have a new messiah, basically. So I think that wraps up our conversation on Dune. Our final verdict, the movie Dune.
Top-notch quality all the way. Go buy it now. Buy two copies like I've got.
I agree. It's definitely worth rewatching, especially if you've not read the books and you're going into it cold. Watch both versions, the theatrical and the extended, because you watch watch the extended first and then the theatrical.
You can't go wrong.
Because the extended gives you all the background you sort of need, and then the theatrical is a better film altogether.
And then read the book.
And read all six books and all the sequels by Brian Herbert and Kevin J. Anderson.
Maybe not.
Doubleday Publishing, give us some money. All right, so we're going to move on to the TV corner. So today's TV Corner, we're going to talk a little bit about Futurama.
It's a great show. Love it. Watched it for years.
And we are so happy it's back on the air.
Oh.
Yeah, Futurama just came back with the second half of the sixth season this month.
I don't know how they're classifying it. They're back for another set of 13 new episodes on Comedy Central. And like everything we discuss on the show, it has occasional religious themes.
Some of our favorite little bits, of course, it would be the Robot Devil.
Oh, the Robot Devil's great. Voiced by Dan Castellaneta in two or three episodes. He's not really demonic. He's the overlord of Robot Hell.
An actual physical place where robots go when they're bad.
Whether or not they're corporeal, it seems to vary depending on the episode we see it in. He's not so demonic as much as he's an old-timey 30s mustache-twirling villain. Yeah. Only with dialogue instead of silent.
Yeah, and then there's his counterpart, the evangelical robot. What's his name?
I have no idea.
I have no idea, but he's voiced by Phil Lamar. What's that episode where Bender starts juicing?
He's jacking on.
That's right, with electricity, and he gets saved
by the preacher bot. His name is Preacher Bot.
By Preacher Bot, and then he has a special circuit attached to his front. Mm-hmm. He starts boozing and hanging out with the fembots, and ends up in the hands of the Robot Devil.
I like how they keep showing the Space Pope. He's like a lizard alien, but in Vestal garb.
Yes.
It started.
It was in a recent episode.
And he had dialogue for the first time. The first time we saw him was on one of the old episodes from Fox, that one of the tags at the opening. Every episode under the title, they have a catchphrase that changes every episode. And one of them, complete with picture of the Space Pope, it said, "Condemned by the Space Pope." I just thought that was the funniest thing ever the first time I saw it. Because it just comes out of nowhere, and that's my favorite kind of humor.
Yeah, there's another religious figure in there. I'm not sure what the character name is, but he has a bit of every vestment from every religion. He's like Catholic, evangelical, Jewish, Muslim, Hindu. He's got a little bit of everything. He was in at least one episode. And that's very much emblematic, I think, of our pluralistic society today, where everything is okay. It's like those coexist bumper stickers you see every once in a while.
Or Chrismica on the OC.
And then there's Festivus for the rest of us.
there's Xmas. There's Kwanzaa Bot.
And there's Santa Claus.
Oh, yes.
Cannot forget Santa Claus.
Yes.
As a Christian, I take exception to Santa Claus. It's one of those Christian traditions that I just gets under my skin. I really don't like Santa Claus. I've always disliked Santa Claus, and I have the photos to prove it of me, 3 years old, sitting on Santa's lap, and his lap is very wet.
From you?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I showed Santa what I thought of him. But I love the episodes of Santa Claus where everyone's on the naughty list and he comes to blow you away. And the Santa Claus song, I laugh so hard every time.
I have like two or three favorites, and that's one of them. A Tale of Two Santas, where Bender gets roped into becoming the new robot Santa, and it wraps up all of the Santa tropes and all of the Christmas special. Jesus makes an appearance in the form of Dr. Zoidberg and delivers one of my favorite lines. "I help those who help themselves," as he runs away in terror.
Dr. Zoidberg and the robot. See, I told you we'd get back to the robot.
The show never makes fun of religion. It uses it to comedic effect without making fun of it. It's laughing with it.
Yeah, it's not like South Park where, you know, people leave the show because of a certain sketch about a certain religion. But I think it pokes fun at our views of religion.
Yes.
You know, like how Christmas is actually Xmas.
Except for the episode that aired July 15th when Bender said Christmas. And I immediately shouted out, doesn't he mean Xmas? Apparently that one slipped past all the executive producers.
Yeah, and you know what's funny about that? I have some Christian friends who are upset when people say Xmas instead of Christmas. They're like, are you trying to take the Christ out of it? Really, the X is Christ's first initial in Greek, so that's what the X is, you know.
And it has more to do with being lazy than being non-religious.
Right. I mean, let me ax you something.
That's also from Futurama.
Are you offended by the X in Xmas?
Me personally?
Yeah.
No.
See?
I'm offended by laziness. I'm not offended by people putting the X in Xmas.
I thought I'd ask you because you're an editor, so that doesn't meet your red pen.
I've learned to pick my battles. I lost that one a long time ago.
One of my favorite parts is in the Star Trek episode where they have the Church of Trek.
The Star Wars Trek and the Star Trek Wars.
Yes. That's my favorite bit. So our verdict on Futurama, religious without being confrontational or derogatory.
It's there, but it never beats you over the head. And there's always a joke 5 seconds away about that or something else. So if you can't laugh at Futurama, then we can't help you.
Yeah. So in an effort to do a movie that is not controversial in terms of whether it's good or bad, we're going to do a movie that's actually controversial, but generally held to be of a good quality.
Critically acclaimed, even.
Yeah, even won several awards from a certain academy.
Best Supporting Actress Amy Adams, I believe.
Yes.
She was at least nominated.
Right, and we are talking about the movie Doubt. Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Meryl Streep.
Amy Adams. So we will be discussing that next time. And in our TV corner, we're going to look at one specific episode of the show Babylon 5 with, interestingly enough, Brad Dourif, who's also one of the
cast. Had a small part in Dune.
So we'll be watching that for next time. Well, thank you once again for listening to the Checking the Gate podcast.
All five of you and Mark Ludwig Stinson.
Thank you again for replying to our question. We appreciate your opinion, and we're glad that you shared it with us. If you, too, want to write an email to us, like we said before, send us an email at ctgpodcast.com. Look for us on Facebook under Checking the Gate Podcast.
And follow us on the Twitter, at ctgpodcast.
And you can also find us at our website, ctgpodcast.com. So, that does it for today. This is Robert saying, keep the faith.
And this is Mike saying, peace out. I will bend like a